Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:31 p.m. on Wednesday, March 8, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crissett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Jake Wade from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is Senate Bill 12, Address Confidentiality Program, sponsored by Senator Keel. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Keel and his staff, Ella Atkinson. Please come forward, or in your case, move from your seat to the table. Identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of serving as the Senator for District B here in the capital city in northern southeast Alaska. With me is Ella Atkinson of my office, and we appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 12 today. Senate Bill 12 is an address protection program. It is geared toward survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. It also includes protections for peace officers and correctional officers within the state of Alaska. The prompt for this bill came from a former legislator and a conversation in which she described her pre-legislative work in victim services. She told the story of someone who had survived domestic violence and sexual assault and had so feared for her life and the life of her family that she needed to leave her previous home. She came to Alaska, and in the interest of protecting her family, she got a post office box rather than having mail delivered to her home. But she did do things like register to vote, which any American has the right to do.
Quick pause. Just want to recognize Senator Tobin has also joined us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. that's where the story turns. This particular individual happened fortuitously to see her stalker outside the post office when she was going to get her mail before he saw her. Participating in civic life in Alaska creates public records. Not just registering to vote, there are many other things we do as Alaskans that create public records that often contain an address. What this bill does is provide those who have had a protective order for against a stalker, against a DV assailant, against a sexual assailant, with the opportunity to use a state of Alaska post office box. Their first-class mail, their official mail, will go to that address and then be forwarded on to their actual mailing address with confidentiality protections afforded to that actual mailing address. They can participate in all the things we do as Alaskans without creating a public record that could lead an assailant to them. The bill also includes peace officers and correctional officers. That is prompted in part by some efforts a few years ago. There's no polite way to say it, to create DoxaCop websites. There was one in the greater Fairbanks area where folks comb public records and the internet to post the addresses, the personal information, the children's schools of peace officers. I should be clear. Nothing in Senate Bill 12 is going to erase you from the internet. If you and your household members, children, etc., have created an online presence that has pictures of your front door or your school, those things, Senate Bill 12 won't erase them. This helps in the much, much less frequent case where someone has truly restarted their lives, or where someone starting a career in public safety has taken seriously the admonition given at the Correctional Academy, given at the police, the Trooper Academy, to stay off of those sorts of websites to protect yourself and your family. In those cases, those people can use the Address Protection Registry under Senate Bill 12 to keep themselves and their families safe. Mr. Chairman, that's the heart and soul of the bill. Put myself in your hands as to what you would like next, whether a sectional, a description of the changes made in the State Affairs Committee, or just go to questions.
We've also got some invited testimony. If there's no questions from the committee yet, and I don't see any questions, if we could get the sectional, and then if you want to identify, well, the sectional and the changes from State Affairs, and I'm not sure, I'll let you choose it with the order of those.
I'm going to do the sectional on the bill as it stands now. I'll turn to Ms. Atkinson, please.
Thank you. For the record, Ella Atkinson, staff to Senator Keel. Section 1 puts the program in the Department of Administration. Section 2 creates the program, requires a single post office box for enrollees to use as a substitute mailing address for mail forwarding purposes, requires enrollees' real addresses be kept confidential, describes program eligibility, requires state and municipal agencies to accept the PO box, describes the 5-year eligibility period, forbids the department from charging a fee, allows access to confidential addresses subject to a search warrant, establishes penalties for unlawfully revealing a protected individual's address. Section 3 establishes a transition period for the department to adopt regulations to implement the program. Section 4 lets the department begin its regulation process immediately. And Section 5 sets an effective date of January 1st, 2024 for the rest of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if it's the will of the committee, I can describe briefly, and I prefer conceptually, the changes made in State Affairs. The initial rendition of the bill put a number of strictures on the court system for peace officer and correctional officer addresses. Those turn out, after significant conversation with the court system, not to be necessary. The court system only really has an interest in addresses for the service of process and the provision of documents and copies, and they have a long-standing practice of allowing peace officers and correctional officers who need to be in court to list their work address for those purposes. We could find no situation where a judge might require the home address of someone. So those turned out to be unnecessary and were removed from the bill. We also took out a reference to one type of protective order that involves protecting minors and folks with disabilities from the financial dissipation of assets and things. These are not physical safety concerns. So we took that out as a protective order that would qualify for participation in the registry. And the final thing, I'm sorry, was to fine-tune the definition of household members who may participate in the registry. Obviously, it wouldn't do a whole lot of good only to have the person who had left a violent situation protected and to have their household members not eligible. So those who reside in the same household as an individual enrolled in the program are eligible.
I don't see questions. The only query, my memory in State Affairs is there were some questions about the fiscal note. I know it's creating a new program in the Department of Administration. Have those fiscal questions been kind of ironed out?
Mr. Chairman, the department has refined their fiscal note. We worked cooperatively with many different folks within the executive branch. It won't surprise the committee to learn nobody had a couple staff lying around not doing anything they could dedicate to a brand new program. And so there is a fiscal impact to the bill. I think it is a fairly responsible fiscal note, 2 full-time positions to administer the program, and some limited startup costs.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Keel, for bringing this piece of legislation forward. I've shared with you last year how this would have applied to my family, as my father's a state trooper, and there was significant fear after some things happened to his with his address being released and having to be relocated here to Juneau. I particularly am interested in the definition of peace officer. I see within the statute that the definition includes United States Marshal. I am curious if this would also apply to anyone who is doing work as or can be commissioned as a state trooper but may be a federal law officer, someone who might be a brown shirt or potentially work in Bureau of Land Management or Fish and Wildlife, as sometimes in very rural spaces or other locales, there are strong emotions about those particular federal agents, and ensuring that they are also protected is something I think we could all think is probably prudent.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Tobin's question, we use the bill uses the broad definition of peace officer in Title I of our statutes, and I will double check on the application, but the intention was that anyone effectively who's a certificated badge wearing peace officer would be qualified.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, wondering if you, in the preparation of this creation of it, looked into any of the commercial operations that there's, I know for people that travel, there's mail forwarding services, and I'm wondering if the same utility might be gained without the creation of a, you know, of a new working group in the government by accessing commercially available mail forwarding system, perhaps with some sideboards around it, but achieving the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Kaufman, the bill is really geared toward the minimal provision of forwarding necessary for folks to participate in public life and things that would create public records. So this is not going to serve as a forwarding system for your Amazon packages. Neither does it place additional requirements or strictures on private sector shippers, private sector mailers. So those, you know, generally nowadays you can get your bills by email, which can be very helpful. The concern that we're working to address here really has to do with one's ability to do things that would create publicly available records, right down to, you know, there's a form at the DMV you can use to find out the address of the registered owner of a vehicle. You have to promise that you're not using it for improper purposes, but it's a misdemeanor to cheat, right? A person who is concerned about their safety is going to prefer to use a post office box through this address protection program. This matches, I'm going to look to Ms. Atkinson, I believe it is 41 other states that currently have similar programs. And as to the precise implementation, we left almost all the details to the department by regulation. And so as we worked with them, neither they nor we found a commercial service that would do the job in lieu of the state today. But it's open should that program exist and satisfactorily protect the safety of protected persons tomorrow.
Senator Kaufman.
I appreciate, through the chair, I appreciate that response. I do know, again, I have some family members that use these types of services, you know, for like full-time travel. And I know that the services may not be in Alaska, but, you know, so they're still there. So what I'll say is I look forward to just discussing with you that further offline. Thanks.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from the committee. I know that you've got some invited testimony online. We'll start with Susie Pearson, Director of the Abuse Women's Aid in Crisis. Ms. Pearson, can you hear us?
Hello, good afternoon.
Please proceed.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify to the chair and members of the committee. My name is Susie Pearson, and I am the Executive Director for Abuse Women's Aid in Crisis, or AWAKE, in Anchorage. I'm testifying on SB 12, the Address Confidentiality Program. AWAKE is in support of SB 12, and I encourage members of the committee to support this legislation. AWAKE is in a public location in Anchorage, and AWAKE serves as a mail warehouse for most of our participants to include both shelter and non-residential participants. Those that come to shelter need a new place to receive critical mail, such as housing and benefits information. As such, they use AWAKE as their primary address. Many do not change it for extended periods of time because they don't want their abuser to know where they are once they leave AWAKE, the AWAKE shelter. AWAKE participants are not limited to individuals with protective orders. Expanding the scope of those who can access the program would be beneficial to many victims of crime that may choose not to get a protective order for their own reasons. Using Awake as a primary residence can put our shelter at risk. We feel that having a confidential address program would stop Awake from being a primary target of abusers that find out their victims are staying in or receiving mail at our shelter. I request that you approve SB 12 and consider expanding the scope of those who do not have a protective order. I would like to thank Senator Keel for bringing this legislation forward. Thank you so much, and have a good day.
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much. Next, we've got Keely Olson from Standing Together Against Rape. Ms. Olson, if you would like to put yourself on the record, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. This is Keely Olson with STAR in Anchorage, and I'm here today to speak in support of SB 12. Thank you for taking time to hear this important piece of legislation, and thank you so much to the bill's sponsor, Senator Keel. Prior to working at STAR, I was a victim advocate with a prosecuting attorney's office in Washington State. Washington's address confidentiality program was an essential tool used by victim advocates to assist anyone with high lethality risk to be safer. Combined with comprehensive safety planning and emergency relocation plans, and done in a very particular order, the address confidentiality program was a lifesaver for more than a few of my clients. While the program was accessible and easy to use, I didn't see the program being used in inappropriate ways and never heard of it being a burden on state administrators. Address confidentiality programs are currently available in, I believe, up to 40 states nationwide at no cost to enrollees, which is an important benefit. I recall there were avenues to accessing the Washington program without the necessity of a current civil protective order being in place, so I do advocate for additional paths to being available for those who feel endangered by seeking such orders, such as criminal no-contact orders, criminal charges filed, criminal history, and supporting letters from crime victim advocates who would be in a position to advise the state. I also know law enforcement officers and district attorneys personally who use public and private names and put their own real estate and personal property, like cars, in a spouse or family member's name to protect their confidentiality. So I can appreciate the reason for the inclusion of public servants serving in law enforcement as well. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of the bill. Thank you all for your hard work in increasing safety for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Next, we have Mike Radgowski from the Alaska Police Officers Association. Mr. Radgowski.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Michael Radgowski, and I am the Far North Chapter President of the Alaska State Alaska Peace Officers Association. I'm also an officer with the Alaska State Troopers Judicial Services Unit as a court services officer. As a representative of the APOA State Board, we would like to give our support to SB 12, as it would assist law enforcement in doing their jobs, knowing that their loved ones at home were protected by having their personal location and information secured from exposure due to reports or court documents or records being published. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see questions from the committee. Next is Randy McClellan with the Alaska Correctional Officers Association.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Randy McClellan. I'm president of the Alaska Correctional Officers Association. I'm also a staff sergeant with the department, having served over 25 years. We have about 950 correctional officers spread out through 12 different facilities across the state. And unfortunately, physical assault and threats of harm against correctional officers and their families is commonplace. SB 12 helps ensure correctional officers and their families. Personal information won't be provided unnecessarily to those that may wish them harm. And I'm very appreciative for this legislation. Thank you for looking out for correctional officers and all peace officers.
Thank you very much. I don't see questions from the committee. There's no one else listed for invited testimony. And I know committee members have had questions so far, so we are next going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 21. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not clear and often difficult to hear what you're saying. But first I'll ask, is there anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony on Senate Bill 12? Seeing no one in the room and seeing no one online, I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 12. At this time, we're going to hold the bill for further review, and we're going to take a brief at ease while the projector is set up for our next presentation. Second and final order of business today is a presentation on the Alaska Bar Rule 43, or on Alaska Bar Rule 43.5 in the Community Justice Worker Program. We're joined today by Nicole Nelson, Executive Director of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. Ms. Nelson, thank you for joining us today. If you want to identify yourself for the record, then you can begin your remarks.
Okay. For the record, my name is Nicole Nelson, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services. And I want to thank you all for holding this hearing today and letting me tell you a little bit about Alaska Legal Services' new project, the Community Justice Worker Program. I hope to do three things today. First, I'm going to introduce those of you who may not be familiar with the work that Alaska Legal Services does, give you a little background about what our mission is and why we exist. And then I want to talk with you about how we about what the state of the civil justice gap is in Alaska and why we have developed this new Community Justice Worker Program, which is the first of its kind in the nation, and we're very excited about that. And so thank you so much for this opportunity. So first off, as I said, I'm Nicole Nelson, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services. I came up to Alaska in 1998, and I've been working for ALSC since that time. I've been the Executive Director for the last 10 years. And Alaska Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm that's been providing free civil legal aid in Alaska since 1967. And we have offices throughout the state. Our job is to make sure that justice is a reality for all Alaskans, not just those who can afford it. And we do that by providing help to folks on their civil as opposed to criminal legal needs. And that's because, for those of you who may not be familiar, you don't have, in a criminal case, if you're accused of a crime, you have a right to an attorney, a public defender, to represent you if you can't afford one. But there is no such constitutional right in the civil context. And so people who don't have the means or don't have access in many of our remote communities, where private attorneys don't exist, are often left without help. And so ALSC was born in 1967 to try to address those unmet civil legal needs. So today, ALSC has 12 offices throughout our state. We are really excited, we really appreciate that we have been able to maintain a statewide footprint during this time. And so we have offices located in most of the hub communities where there is also a superior court. And we rely on a variety of, we're a nonprofit, we rely on a variety of different funding sources. We are grateful for a state appropriation, we receive some federal dollars, and we also, I'm happy to say, receive support from every community where we maintain a local office. And our office priorities are set, they're guided by input from our local communities and approved by our governing board, which is drawn from all of the community. We have our 15-member board, which is includes regional representation throughout the state. So this is a little map that shows where our offices are located. Our overall total budget is about $7 million, and we have a 50-person plus staff, 12 statewide offices, and we also have several medical legal partnership offices as well, which I'll tell you about a little bit later. And so in any given year, we're able to help resolve about 3,700 cases impacting close to 8,000 Alaskans and folks that are residing in 176 different Alaskan communities. So we get out there and we're doing a good job about, well, a fairly good job, I'll get to the next point, of reaching out beyond the hub communities and beyond those on the road system. But we're still missing a lot of people who need our help. One other thing I'd like to point out as we go along is that in 2012, with support from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, there was an economic benefit study done of the work that we provide, and it found that for every dollar invested in our program, there was a 5-to-1 return on all funds invested in our program, and that we received positive outcomes in 86% of the cases where we are providing services.
Senator Kaufman has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just curious how these metrics are developed. So how was the 5-to-1 ratio determined?
Sure.
And it, positive outcomes 86% of the time. So if you could describe what, maybe you will later, what a positive outcome is and how that stacks up to that percentage rate. Thank you.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. So two things. I can share the study with you that shows how the 5-to-1 return on investment was calculated. Essentially, there was a formula that looked at outcomes related to avoiding domestic violence. So if we have people who are not going into emergency shelter or avoiding healthcare costs because they have a civil protective order in place, that was one measure. Also avoiding homelessness by avoiding illegal foreclosures or evictions. Those were a couple of different measures. And then also we were able to draw down benefits that people were entitled to. So for instance, veterans oftentimes are not able to go through the bureaucratic process of drawing down federal veterans benefits or Social Security benefits. And with our assistance, we were able to bring those down, and then those dollars would circulate in the community. And I can get you a copy of that as well. And insofar as positive outcomes are achieved in 86% of the cases, that's a really good question. That statistic was derived from the clients that we were representing and their perceptions of whether the outcomes that they were hoping to achieve through the cases. So it's an 86% success rate based on clients reporting that they achieved what they wanted.
Thank you. I would like to see that. I appreciate the information.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send that to you right after.
And if you want to, you can send it to my office and we'll circulate it to the committee.
I will do that.
I don't see other questions. Please proceed.
Great. So the statistics I've stated up until now are sort of the things that are bragging rights, the things that we're very happy about and the work that we do. But unfortunately, there is an enormous gap. And so the things I'm not so excited about and the things that I worry about and that keep me up at night are the fact that because of our limited resources, we are forced to turn away one person for everyone that comes to our doors. And so these are our neighbors. These are folks who need help. And these are with critical legal needs. These are cases that have merit. And there are laws that will protect them. But we are turning them away because we simply don't have the resources to help. And this has been the same story that we've been trying to address basically since we opened our doors in 1967 through various means. And this is not anomalous in Alaska. As it turns out, in the lower 48, the studies show that about 92% of people who have a civil legal need are unable to get those addressed. And so there are two things. First, legal aid organizations like Alaska Legal Services are under-resourced. And then also there's another problem that people often don't identify the problems that they're facing as a legal challenge in the civil context. And so the latest statistics are about 92% of people who have a civil legal problem are not getting the help that they need, either because they don't identify the problem as a civil legal need, or they aren't able to connect with a legal aid organization or a private attorney. So that's the justice gap scenario. So they refer to this as a justice gap. I would like to call it a justice crisis. I think if we have a system where 92% of people can't access the help that they need in it, we're beyond a gap you could step over. We're in full-on crisis mode. And so here's where we turn to the work that our community has done to think about how we might make a difference in addressing, in to turn the curve and try to address more of these needs. So in about 2017, the Alaska Supreme Court just had a Justice for All Commission. And we came together as a community to try to better understand what was happening within our community and what the landscape looked like and what people were actually doing. There's 92% of people who weren't coming, accessing the legal system, and those who were getting turned away. And so we learned a couple of things through this commission. The first is that we sought to understand what people did when they understood that they had a legal problem. And we learned that Alaska Legal Services was the most referred to legal entity in this state when people had a civil legal need, that we're a trusted community resource, and so we're happy about the numbers. But again, that doesn't help the fact that we're turning away people. So the second thing that the Justice for All committee worked on, it was to try to understand, and this is with the court system, really where the lawyers were located. And if you look at this, if you look at the square on my left, at the top left, you'll see there are little green dots and little and bigger blue dots. And the blue dots are where the private attorneys in Alaska are located, and the green dots are where sort of the public defenders are or Alaska Legal Services. And so you can see, and it's probably no surprise to anybody in this room, most of the lawyers are located in the bigger communities and along the road system, with a few others in the more public attorneys are located, or Alaska Legal Services in the hub communities. But there are huge swaths of Alaska that have no legal representation at all, and certainly no private legal representation. So the second thing we wanted to understand is who had a bigger footprint than the legal community in Alaska, and where we might be able to, for lack of a better word, borrow some infrastructure. And we learned that in the folks who had the biggest system footprint in Alaska were the medical providers. So down to the community level, the Alaska Native Tribal Health System has community health aides in almost every community within Alaska. And when we learned this fact, we thought, you know what? I wonder if they've got some extra bandwidth that we could borrow, we could partner in some way so we could further distribute our resources. And so in 2017, Alaska Legal Services started partnering with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and other regionally operated tribal health providers to build a network of medical legal partnerships. Okay, and what we learned during that time is that the issues, the unmet civil legal needs that we were addressing, those such as loss of housing, family violence, debt and finances, and health problems, these were all things that the healthcare system had an interest in resolving as well. And so it's a good partnership because we're both looking to address those same things. And there was recognition that what we were calling these life-altering legal problems, the healthcare professionals refer to as social determinants of health. And so we decided to partner, and we began developing, embedding Alaska Legal Services staff within the healthcare system. And that was a really great way for us to sort of share resources and share the greater infrastructure. It also turned out to be very transformative for Alaska Legal Services, because we ended up learning that the healthcare system had been trying to address the problem of having a lack of healthcare professionals in rural communities for a very long time. And they had models developed, such as the Community Health Aid Program, the Behavioral Health Aid Program, and the Dental Health Therapist Program, that were meant to address just the problem that that we were seeing with respect to a lack of lawyers. And so we started partnering with ANTHC and Alaska Pacific University to try to replicate the community-based healthcare provider program in the legal context. And so in 2019, we started developing training, curriculum and training programs in partnership with ANTHC and APU that would help us train and support a local community justice-based workforce. And so this happened right before the pandemic started. And so I was a little bit worried that the project would fall apart. But it turned out that it was really very successful. So we had designed asynchronous distance learning modules that anybody could take, and they would volunteer. They would take the training programs and then agree to take on a case for Alaska Legal Services to help someone in their community. And so fast forward, we were recruiting folks. We have recruited over 200 people, and they come from various affiliated organizations, whether they're tribal organizations, healthcare organizations, social services organizations. Some folks are undergrad students, and also law students who are going to school in the lower 48 have been recruited and have gone through our training modules and have volunteered to take on cases to help their community members in Alaska. To date, again, we have, as I said, we've recruited over 200 folks. 100 have completed courses, and 101 are still progressing through the training programs. So armed with this information, we went to the Bar Association and the Alaska Supreme Court and said, would it be possible to get a bar rule that would allow us to upskill these workers and create pathways so that they could practice in court or could provide other sorts of representation in the future? And on November 2022, the Alaska Supreme Court approved Alaska Bar Rule 43.5, which is a waiver that will allow folks who are properly trained and supervised by Alaska Legal Services and providing services to Alaska Legal Services clients with informed consent to be able to provide limited scope legal services. So now with the waiver in place, we're looking to create a training program that models the training programs for the community health aides, behavioral health aides, and the dental health therapists, so that they would be able to sort of remake model in the legal sphere the same system that's already happened. And so a couple of things that I'm pretty excited about, too. So as part of this project, we were the recipient of 1 in 50 National Sciences Foundation Civic Opportunities Grant. So 50 different projects within the nation on any scope were chosen in the initial stage where they had the opportunity to really change a problem that was endemic throughout the U.S. and could the project had the potential to scale nationally to help address a huge problem that was happening in the lower 48. We were one of those recipients, and now we've moved on to stage two. They will select 20 out of the 50 will be recipients of $1 million investment over the course of a year to sort of expand the program and bring it to scale. And so we'll find out. We just submitted that the proposal on March 1st. We should find out in the next couple of months. And we're really excited because of we're working with national researchers, including Becky Sandifer, who is a MacArthur Genius Award-winning Access to Justice researcher, who is working with us to make sure help us scale this project up and to expand it throughout Alaska and also export it to the lower 48. I'm excited about the opportunities here. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'm not sure if I heard correctly, but the term, was it asynchronous learning modules? And if you would just, for the folks at home, explain what an asynchronous learning module is.
I will. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. Yes, asynchronous, and this was a new word for me too, which is on demand. So you can do it at your own pace, at your own time. And so that's sort of one of the things that we're trying really hard to do with all of the trainings and our modules is to make them available to a wide variety of folks at different times. And we're trying to use sort of a bespoke model of the training folks so that we are not having, we envision having our training centers that would allow for experiential learning and apprenticeship type programming and as well as online distance learning opportunities as well as those same opportunities that might be available in person, right? So we're striving to have sort of a no wrong door approach, to have standards so that the community knows what they're getting, but avoiding over credentialing and making sure that people, you know, that we are developing a competent workforce that is based on their experience in providing the services. Our experience tells us for the last 40, 50 years that we've been running the program, we often have volunteers who are coming through our program who learn on the job. This is how we teach baby attorneys to do their job. They learn through doing, and I think that there's the same way that we could do that with a community justice workforce too. And, you know, much of the work that we do at Alaska Legal Services, you know, it's not all filing things in court. It's oftentimes people need like a will or some just transactional work. And with, you know, just time and attention and having sort of a checklist or skills, we feel that we'll be able to train up a competent workforce, a legal workforce of non-lawyers to help address the issues.
Follow up?
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I just wanted to differentiate it from non-synchronous learning, which is when the course is happening but the student isn't paying attention.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And this is more of just a comment, because I really enjoy and appreciate your program. And I know one of your volunteers of the month of July last year, Aaron Lilly, is experiencing some adverse health effects. And I just wanted to mention how important he is to the community of Nome and the work that he did in Nome, how critical it was.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, yes. Aaron Lilly is he was on our board for many, many years and has been a great contributor to access to justice in Alaska. Thank you for bringing that up.
I don't see other questions from the committee. And how is the funding, where's most of the funding coming for the new program?
Right. So two things. For the new program, so far to date, we've been the recipient of various it's called Pro Bono Innovation Fund grant opportunities through the Legal Services Corporation. And that's how we've stood up the training modules that have existed to date. Also, ANTHC has been incredibly generous in helping us design using their distance learning professionals to help us design the training modules that have already existed. Alaska Legal Services has also been putting in some of our just general dollars, because we believe this is the way that we're going to be able to move things forward for our community. Moving forward, again, we have the opportunity for the National Sciences Foundation grant that would invest $1 million into the program if we receive that. And we are also asking for making a capital request within this legislative budget and within this legislative cycle for $500,000 that would help us invest in and match with that $1 million that comes from the National Sciences Foundation grant to build out the sort of standards and credentialing things that we need to stand up the training center and to really help scale the program.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. And that brings us to the end of our day, or at least the end of the committee's day. We will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, March 10th. It's 1:30 p.m., and that we will stand adjourned. The time is 2:15 p.m.